Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership.
If there's a fundamental intellectual error in the way our schools approach science, it is the lack of context. The general approach is to focus on methods and concepts as foundational, rather than on narrative and context. For example, by the time a child reaches the age where they begin the more serious study of science, they'll be introduced to a series of abstractions, coming in the form of either a lab work that primarily serves the purpose of teaching scientific methods rather than instilling in a child a sense of wonder and place in the world, or b, concepts that, while foundational to the study of science in an academic field, are relatively meaningless for a child. Instead, the focus of scientific study must begin with narrative. Before we get into the cosmology based on the scientific narrative, we should understand more about what a cosmology is and some alternative cosmologies. This begins with an inquiry into the nature of myth and narrative. A cosmology always comes in the form of a story. This is true of science as well as myth. There are, of course, epistemological differences between scientific and mythic approaches to the world, but the aim of neither is to merely convey knowledge, is to integrate knowledge into a coherent story. The scientific approach has the advantage of a rigorous method that is open to change. The mythic approach has the advantage of being conscious of the values it conveys. So, rather than beginning the study of science with scientific methods or abstraction, we begin with an exploration into the nature of cosmology and narrative. This is entirely rooted in neuroscientific understandings of how the brain works, and we should be teaching based on this brain science, for we understand now that we process information through story. This is why, for example, giving people more facts about climate change doesn't affect their belief about it. The story of scientific cosmology, therefore, begins with the creation myths that preceded it. This can come in forms students are familiar with, such as the Bible, but can and should also include creation stories from various cultural traditions. None of this is about teaching religion, rather is an investigation into the nature of human consciousness. For modern science, this means the story of the universe, the broader story within which all studies of science and history fit. Sam King is an environmental educator, public speaker, writer, coach, and activist. He serves as Director of Sustainability for the United States Marist School Network and Project Manager for the Journey of the Universe Film and Multimedia Project. A former teacher in Peru, Sri Lanka, and Connecticut, he holds a Master of Arts in Religion and Ecology from Yale Divinity School with a certificate in Educational Leadership and Ministry. Sam is passionate about how the new story of cosmic evolution can help inspire the transition to a more just and sustainable world. Sam King, welcome to Reimagining.
Thank you, Theodore. It's great to be with you today.
So I wanted to start by hearing a little bit about your background, and because, you know, today we're going to talk about the story of the universe, why that's important, and also how we can educate to kind of cultivate a sense of ecological and cosmological awareness, which has been kind of a lot of your work. But I'd like to start with you by hearing how you became aware, how you sort of had your awakening in order to see the necessity of helping not just individuals, but helping a civilization move in a direction of more cosmological awareness. Where did that come from for you? Because it's not part of our typical educational experience for most of us.
Absolutely. So thank you again for having me and for the great question, Theodore. And I'd like to start by telling you a little bit about my early teaching experience after college. And I had spent a year in rural Sri Lanka, studying agrarian Buddhism and following a passion for the history of religions that I've followed during my time in college. And so when I returned to the States, I found a teaching position teaching philosophy and religion at an independent school in rural Connecticut. And I really wanted to talk to young people about meaning and what it means to be alive and where we come from and how we should live and to create conversations about how we can co-create a better future. And so I started off in that position at the Hotchkiss School in Lakeville, Connecticut. And during my second year there, I came across a program called Journey of the Universe at a nearby retreat center. And I was interested. So I drove through the countryside to a place called Wisdom House. And I heard Professors Mary Evelyn Tucker and John Grimm introduce this multimedia project called Journey of the Universe, which is weaving together contemporary science with the ancient spiritual insights of different human cultures to tell an epic story of cosmic evolution. And that encounter with the universe story as an interconnected paradigm for where we come from, and to see my own identity as enveloped in the larger processes of the earth and the universe, was life-changing. So I decided to follow Mary Evelyn Tucker and John Grimm to Yale Divinity School a few years later, where I studied with them and have now worked with them for the past 3 years. And my work really centers on trying to promote the Journey of the Universe project and to deepen our sense of embeddedness in the Earth systems and in the larger universe we inhabit. And that's with this ethical understanding that we need a sense of regeneration as a human community. And we need to reimagine who we are and to really reorient our institutions toward a more harmonious presence with the planet. And we can do that through story and through the awe-inspiring narratives that guide our life decisions and our sense of who we are.
That's an amazing way that you had that experience. What's really important, I think, is the way in which if we talk about, and it's hard because our language sometimes gets in the way, like we don't have always the right language to talk about these things. Because when we talk about the universe, we're also talking about ourselves. When we talk about cosmos, we're also talking about the cosmos within each of us. There's not that rigid distinction between self and universe. When we enter into a deeper understanding of that, it sort of breaks down, doesn't it? That dualism between the two.
Absolutely. And we begin to see that the very forces of contraction and expansion in the early universe are the same forces that inhere in our very bodies, and that our bodies are made up of the elements formed by exploded stars. And so we begin to see that our deepest identity is in communion with, interpenetrating with the larger universe at every moment. Yeah, helping young people experience that sense of connectedness amidst the sense of alienation and nihilism and despair that plagues so many of our young people, I think it has such transformative potential.
That's a really great and important point. I think that you know, one of my children did a play on space, and it was really cool. It was great. They did a great job, but they missed a part of it, in that when they described the expanding universe, mm-hmm. they described it as if it was the stuff, the matter and energy that was expanding into space rather than space itself expanding. So it's like when you ask the question, where did the Big Bang happen? The answer is it happened right here. It happened everywhere, right? It's still happening in each of us, right?
Yeah. And the unique approach we take with the Journey of the Universe project compared to, for instance, Big History, which has a more materialistic portrayal of the evolutionary of the universe, is Journey sees the human as the self-reflexive consciousness of the universe itself, as an intimate partner to all of life. And so the universe process is actually unfolding through each of us. Right. So there's that inextricable connection and that sense of meaning, right? Science is absolutely fundamental in revealing these transformative insights, but we need humanities. We need reflection on what these insights mean in a more embodied and affective sense.
Yeah, I think that's a hugely important point. And I mean, I think that I like to think of how, and I one of the things I love that you all are still doing, and I think that's that Thomas Berry lineage, you know, that it's an understanding that there are new ways to integrate these ancient insights, but it's not an abandoning of them. There's a respect for the ancient wisdom of, say, Confucianism or Buddhism, just to use two examples. I really think I appreciate, even though those traditions didn't kind of have the same sense of evolution, maybe, that we do in when we look at modern science, but they still had a respect for, and I'll talk about a little bit about Buddhist philosophy. There's this notion that our world is fundamentally relational, that relationship is actually the stuff, not that you talked about how that in some cases people have a more materialistic view of cosmic evolution. What's actually, I think, in a lot of ways, most fundamental, and particularly we get down to the quantum level, we understand that the most fundamental thing in our world, in our universe, is the relationship, that nothing exists without relationship. Even to the point that our minds and our emotions and our thoughts are part of that integrated relationship. It's the wisdom of ecology and of cosmic evolution, but also of ancient traditions like Buddhist philosophy too.
Absolutely. And in the Journey of the Universe project, we talk about how we are 99% genetically similar to primates, and we are descended from early prokaryotic cells in geothermal vents in the deep ocean. And that deep sense of interconnectedness converges with ancient Buddhist insights about dependent origination,
pratichit samuppada,
the intercausal matrix of all life. And when we talk about humans as the mind and heart of the cosmos, that's actually a Confucian insight about our embeddedness in these concentric circles of being. So Journey of the Universe is seeing science as converging with these ancient spiritual insights, and together we are co-creating this larger story of who we are. And this is an ongoing process that we want to invite young people, especially, into developing and creating, right? Telling their own stories in ways that converge with these deeper wellsprings of emergence from the earth and from the larger cosmos that created us.
You know, it's, I think what's really important that you just said too, two things, is that you make reference to the importance of telling a story, and you're offering sort of an invitation to younger people to participate in that storytelling act. I used to have this, I don't want to call it argument, debate, let's call it, with one of my advisors when I was in graduate school. He had a background as a scientist, and we were both very much concerned with climate change and the ecological catastrophe that was before us. I think in a lot of ways, while we both were steeped in this kind of like importance of the work of Thomas Berry and Brian Swim, and we both understood the idea of that there was a role for a story in that, I think for him, it was more like the story was the vehicle to get the information to people so they fully understood it. And I would say that that's true, that people do need the information, but I don't think that having information is actually the goal. I think the actual primary part is the story. And I think that there's kind of like a need to invite, and this is really important, to invite people, maybe of a younger generation, of all different kinds of backgrounds, to participate in the telling of that story. Because it's not like the information is concrete or permanent. We're all sort of a little bit in Plato's cave. No matter how much we think we know, we're always kind of there, I think. And having that invitation to have this never-ending process of reimagining that story is so important. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And Thomas Berry had this profound insight that every living being is telling its own story. Mm. You know, and you can see even in the soil itself, the way soil retains memory. You know, I live here in Connecticut, where we have had a lot of industrialism and I live down the street from an arms factory that tainted all of our local soil with lead, right? So the soil carries that story within it of the industrial devastation that happened to really fuel militarism in this region. So the idea that the universe is telling its story all around us in a unique symphony of ways, I think, opens up so many pathways for people to connect their sense of particularity, their unique story, with this larger emerging story that we're continuing to kind of discover together. I think you're completely right that information alone doesn't move people. We see that with the climate crisis, with biodiversity loss, et cetera, that we need to really move people's hearts and elicit a sense of connectedness to the larger world we inhabit. And story is one of our primary, most ancient ways of doing that.
Yeah. And I love what you said about different species having different ways of telling that story. It reminds me of this fundamental misunderstanding of the notion of evolution. And what I mean is, I think that sometimes we speak of evolution as if the human is more evolved and more intelligent than the oak tree or the fruit fly or the lion, let's just say. Whereas I would suggest that every species at this moment is equally evolved, and insofar as we are all participating at this moment in a holistic process, right? And equally intelligent, because we each have our own unique intelligence. I mean, the intelligence of the human comes in a particular form. It's no better than the intelligence of the oak tree, because the oak tree is ingenious at doing what the oak tree does. Now, I will say this, though, speaking to what you said, the human does have a particular kind of intelligence and kind of gift and kind of role. And I would suggest that in a lot of ways, it is in some ways like we are not the fastest animal or don't have the sharpest teeth. But I think in a lot of ways, the thing that we do best is tell stories. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I really appreciate you bringing up that idea of differentiated intelligence. And while Journey of the Universe is a multimedia project for humans to enter into the story, we are trying to evoke this sense of intelligence all throughout the Earth community. And we're discovering that through the mycorrhizal networks, transmitting healing nutrients and warning signals between Douglas fir trees, from the science of Suzanne Simard, or the ways that Clark's woodpeckers can remember thousands of locations of buried nuts in the soil, right? I was just down in Guatemala to see these migratory birds remembering their breeding grounds across thousands of miles. It's a profound form of intelligence, a kind that indigenous peoples have known for millennia. The animate and communicative nature of the natural world, which is being corroborated by so much of contemporary science. So really trying to, through our education, deepen our sense of being a part of a unique community of life. And as you're pointing out, to really illumine what is our unique human role? What is the responsibility we have by virtue of our storytelling capacity, by virtue of our symbolic consciousness? And how do we use those unique faculties of being human to re-enter the larger community of life and live in a mutually enhancing role?
There's an argument for the importance of biodiversity embedded in what you're saying, which I think is linked to the importance of cultural diversity, in that a healthy ecosystem requires a number of different species to play different roles to provide the right balance. And I would suggest that one of the real challenges we have now, I don't think it's an accident that we are facing this planetary crisis and a lack of biological diversity at a moment in which there is a profound lack or diminishment of cultural diversity, in that global industrial capitalism has taken over so much of the planet. And in doing so, in a very kind of, real and literal way, caused a lot of destruction with some of the practices that are involved in that, but also got in the way of finding new pathways, right? Because we have one story, and it's the story of consumption and the story of hyper-individualism. And so there are other stories out there, but we're not listening to those stories because we're only focusing on the one.
Absolutely. And every time a shopping mall is built over a wetland, we are foreclosing the voices of all that biodiversity that is emanating from that ecosystem, right? And every time indigenous peoples are removed from their lands, we're oppressing the traditional ecological knowledge that has stewarded that region for millennia. I was fortunate to go to the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, and offer a talk on the Adivasi peoples of central India around the Hasdeo Aran forest, who have stewarded that region for thousands of years and are being forcibly evicted from that region due to coal development and also due to wildlife refuges, because the government will come in and say that, you know, we need to protect wilderness areas and the human communities need to leave. So when we create that artificial separation between humans and nature and the widespread continual dispossession of indigenous peoples, as you point out, is a huge source of the lack of imagination and the sort of flattening the injustices that come with this, you know, industrial capitalist growth machine that we've created. It's so important to see cultural and ecological diversity as interwoven.
In some ways, it's easy to see how you might find, you know, a different story coming out of indigenous people that, you know, as you described, like in India. Do you find in your work that it's more of a challenge or requires more work to, if you're interfacing with, say, young people who are, you know, living in the United States, like really embedded in this worldview? I mean, because, you know, we've done this work too with Wisdom Projects. You know, at times you're not only, you're encountering so many cultural forces, right, that are reinforcing a particular story. So how do you, or have you been able to find a pathway into really seeing an alternative?
Absolutely. And it is a challenge, I think, in the US, where we are inundated with so many other cultural forces and where the force of advertising and consumerism is just so powerful and widespread. And so many of your young people have devices and social media and all the stories that are laden in those devices and in those forces. But I find that experience can be so transformative. So for instance, last year, I partnered with the Connecticut Experiential Learning Center to do a cosmological education program grounded on a particular parcel of land on ancestral Quinnipiac land here in Connecticut. And the students did a cosmic walk, tracing the 13.8 billion year story of the universe in a concentric circles that you can lay out with a rope, and walking through the various thresholds of the universe story. And they later took that experience and created a local nature trail marking the larger story of the universe using native plants. And they had a dichotomous key to help label native plants for the region and educate visitors. So that kind of experience really connects the dots for kids. And when you can help evoke a sense of relationship, right? They used, at each major threshold, they used local materials like tree bark and leaves and soil to create paintings that represented in some ways the emergence of galaxies, you know, the emergence of stars. What does that look like to you as a young person? And to see this sense of connectedness and awe and wonder that came through letting kids use their imagination and get outside and connect with the land. So I really do believe in the power of that experience and really evoking experiences of encounter with the more than human world and with our human community by building collaborative discussion-based learning environments.
Yeah, the cosmic walk is a great activity. It's cool in that it shows such a small portion of the history of our universe really involves humans. But on the other hand, it shows just how connected we are. You know, there's a literal thread that connects us to the very birth of the universe that you can see because you have this rope that's connected, right? And each of those kind of like, you know, you can do different ways of kind of marking the rope and showing each moment of emergence. But those are our emergence too, right? It's not just like something that happened to someone else. It's those are our ancestors that are happening when the stars are born, when the first mammals arrive, and so on and so forth. Those are all part of our story that's shared, which is a much bigger story than the story of starting in 1776 or something like that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And we need a much larger context for who we are to guide the necessary changes we need to ensure a viable human presence on this planet. And back to what you were saying earlier, Theodore, about information. It's like, I could teach these young people that all of life began in a primeval fireball called the Big Bang. All right, class is over, we'll move on, right? Or
right.
I could, you know, facilitate through Sister Miriam McGillis's ritual, a cosmic walk where, you know, we're playing music and lighting a candle at the center of this concentric spiral and letting kids walk through all the transformations that were necessary to create you and me. And doing that with kids, you know, one student told me last summer, that was the most powerful educational experience I've ever had, right? He was a junior in high school, right? So just facilitating experiences where students can bring in their full self, right? This isn't just a cognitive analytical encounter, right? You talk in your book about the factory model of education where I'm just transmitting facts to a student, right? As like an empty vessel, but rather co-creating this larger story through a sense of experience and encounter, right? And that's something that the Cosmic Walk, for instance, does so well.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment to talk with Sam King about cosmic education.
Our statement of intent. One, the planet and humanity are at a moment of crisis and opportunity and of transition. Two, because we are entering into an unknown future, imagination is paramount. Three, this moment requires new stories, new narratives, new creative works that express this reimagining. Four, we believe that these narratives must challenge and confront the injustices of our day. Five, crisis of the moment is an educational crisis. That is, we must reimagine educational processes in order to reimagine our narratives. Six, we welcome educators, poets, philosophers, activists, and writers who are interested in reimagining ourselves and our relationship to the planet. Seven, reimagining is a place not so much to find quick answers or definitive solutions, rather it is a place to ask big questions, to explore possibilities, and to imagine a new world. You can find more about our work at www.reimaginingmagazine.com and more about our broader mission at www.chicagowisdomproject.org and www.baltimorewisdomproject.org.
So I'm talking with Sam King, who is an environmental educator, public speaker, writer, and activist. Sam is deeply immersed in the work of cultivating a sense of our place in the cosmos with young people and trying to awaken a sense of our ecological place. And I wanted to kind of return, Sam, to something we talked about earlier in our conversation, which was this idea that when we're talking about the evolution of the universe, when we're talking about cosmos, we're also talking about ourselves, and not just our physical selves, but our interior lives. In other words, the emergence of human consciousness, the emergence of a psyche happens not as something separate from the emergence of the physical universe, but is part of that entire process. And in recognizing that, I wanted to kind of talk to you a little bit about how that actually can make a difference, how educating young people for that, to see themselves in that process, can actually help deal with some of the sense of loneliness, sense of all the kind of range of mental health struggles that young people have in today's world. And so how do you see the role of cosmic education and awareness for helping young people deal with their interior lives?
Absolutely. Well, as you cite, we are experiencing unprecedented levels of depression and anxiety among our young people. And so the mental health crisis we face requires a reimagining of our educational structures and our pedagogies. And cosmological education for me is a way of evoking meaning and connectedness for our young people, to reinforce that they are the inheritors of 13.8 billion years of cosmic evolution and transformations that created each one of us. And that is a profound gift beyond measure. And when we approach education ecologically and think about our own role in a larger ecosystem, we realize that every part matters. And you talk about this in your book too, Theodore, about how the physical structure of our classrooms matter, right? Embracing circles or Harkness style pedagogy or any form of teaching that allows each student to see themselves as an integral part of knowledge production. And for me, participatory cosmology, for kids to see themselves as not only the inheritors of all these cosmic processes, but actually writing the next chapter together of the Earth's history is incredibly empowering, right? And I'm doing a lot of this work now as a sustainability director for a network of schools in the US to really help young people feel like they're part of co-creating a more flourishing future. Young people are yearning for a sense of hopeful participation in something larger, right? They know we're facing these huge problems. They want to help. They want to use their imaginations, their creativity to create a better world. So we need to create educational structures that enable that creativity to come forth and flourish.
I think that a sense of lostness and perhaps even alienation can be something that can be used, certainly marginalization can be something that can be used as an asset, can be used as a way of trying to see that the current way that we're doing things is not working, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we can at least accept that as a starting point, we can do that work. The thing you said was so important. And I think that part's often left out too, is the part of, we talked a little bit about the kind of how we've gotten here, the story of the universe in the past, you know, mm-hmm. just like we talk about, you know, that the birth of the universe happens everywhere, right? And that's a wonderful thing to understand our heritage and to understand our connection to things in the past. But the other part of that is that the edge of the universe is actually not a place, it's now. This moment is the edge of the universe everywhere, right? So what that means for each of us is that we are choosing the next chapter, right? We are actually giving birth to something new. And I think there's a different way that we talked about different species and their different roles. There's a different way that an oak tree or a fruit fly would do that from the human. And I think the way that humans do that is actually the exact work you're doing, this work of telling stories and reimagining our world that way through creativity.
Exactly. And that's a great point. And something I want to underscore is that this cosmological education is not simply abstract navel gazing, but a catalyst for action in the here and now. And to really see students' own creativity as the same creativity that forged the spiral-shaped Milky Way galaxy, or that churned a cell from an ocean vent, you know, billions of years ago. And to really inspire that sense of ongoing creativity among students, especially in addressing climate change, biodiversity loss, toxic pollution, systemic racism, all these problems we're facing. And if we give students a larger context of who they are and open up these opportunities for reflecting on their identities, we can inspire just such an outpouring of creativity. And I've seen that in my own educational work, just how inspired students are by this larger ecological, cosmological context, and how it really can activate hopeful solutions to the challenges of our time.
I don't want to put you in the trap of pretending that you know all the answers here, because I think part of this is like what you're describing is having the humility to listen and see what emerges. What would you say if I pressured you to do so, like in terms of what are the things that you feel like we could maybe emphasize in a new story about who we are and our place in the universe with particular attention? Let's just kind of focus it a little bit and paying particular attention to this kind of planetary destruction ecological destruction that's happening now. If you could think about, you know, and it'll come in many different forms and in many different ways and be seen different ways. But like, if you could kind of hone in on what you see as one of the things we're missing about in our story and that we need to remember as far as how we think of that story of our place in the universe.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of things I could say that could just more than answering that. I mean, I can think of Thomas Berry's book, The Dream of the Earth, you know, and this idea that the earth is dreaming itself into conscious self-awareness through the human. And it's such a beautiful insight to think about the power of dreams, the power of imagination, the power of the unconscious becoming conscious through the unfolding of the earth processes and culminating in the human and earth processes we're inhabiting. And so how do we give students in a more tangible sense an opportunity to dream? How do we create project-based learning activities where the culmination of a class is not a multiple choice exam where students have to simply regurgitate answers to pre-prescribed questions, but where students are drawing upon their cognitive faculties, their artistic faculties, their embodied self, their activism to create projects that integrate their knowledge and apply to larger problems that we face. So I appreciate you pointing that, because I don't have the answers as an educator or all the answers to our ecological crises. But what I'm interested in is activating the creativity and the imagination of young people to co-create a more flourishing future that participates in this sense of dream making.
We talked in the past, you and I, Sam, about this notion of a classroom as a metaphor for our world, or a microcosm, you could say. And I'm interested in that as a kind of theory of education and way of thinking about teaching and learning. And I wonder what that means then for you as far as the kind of shape of a classroom. So if I think you have an idea for a sense of what a flourishing community might look like.
Yeah.
And so, or a flourishing earth community even might look like. What does that look like if you kind of take that down to a more microcosmic level, and the level that is of a classroom or a learning space? And when I say classroom, just using that as kind of metaphor for a space in which learning occurs. What does your classroom look like, Sam, with that in mind?
Absolutely. Well, I'm really inspired by Christina Baldwin's idea of circle pedagogy, where learning can happen within a circle. And one of the most inspiring ways I've seen this is at the Ridge and Valley Charter School in New Jersey, which was inspired in large part by the ideas of Maria Montessori, Thomas Berry, and Brian Swim. And it's a land-based school that is teaching kids about the larger story of the universe. And the students bring around these small camping chairs and form circles throughout the land. And they have different classes and exercises, painting the local landscape, bird tracking, growing herbs, and making tea, for instance. And it's a powerful reminder that the classroom is not a space with four walls. Actually, the idea of 90 degrees or hard angles is not something we observe very often in many ecosystems, right? So the idea of circularity, roundness, and creating spaces where students are co-creators of knowledge and of reflection within a learning space, I think is so critical, right? So circle pedagogy, outdoor education, experiential learning, where we're collapsing this boundary between school and worlds, right? School is not just a place for memorizing content and facts, but a place for discovery, for authentic encounter with the texture, the beauty of the world we inhabit.
A circle is also a space. It's also a space that is, I think, a more democratic space. It's a space in which we can, while older person or a person with a particular background may have more knowledge and some kind of area of study, but each person in the circle is seen and heard by others, right? Like each person is there to have a perspective that's shared. And there's also a way in which we can have a conversation in which everyone may not have all of the knowledge, but that wisdom can arise in the conversation where each voice is important in the circle. So I love that notion of learning in a circle.
Absolutely. And the other thing I like to do is to create class covenants. So to have students co-create the kind of learning environment that they want to inhabit. So rather than me coming in and saying on day one, here are all the rules for our class, it's like, what kind of community do you all want to build together? And I've had such wonderful experiences doing that. And if we need reminders throughout the year, we can return to those shared commitments we've made at the outset of the year, right? So again, having students be the co-creators of their learning experience. In your book, I remember you talk about starting with questions, right? Sometimes the most powerful thing teachers can say is, I don't know. Let's find out. Start with a question.
I mean, our universe is more of a question than it is a set of facts, I would suggest, right? So I think that's more consistent with everything that you've brought forth today, is that we're all here asking questions, and that it requires like genuine listening and genuine respect for the student as an agent of wisdom. It requires a certain amount of humility. You know, and it requires courage too. It requires us to not be afraid of letting go of control. And so much, I would suggest, of our challenge as a species is rooted in this need to control things that are beyond us and scary. You know what I mean? It's like this idea that we can control nature because nature is scary. We were afraid of the big predators, so we killed them off. And it turned out that in paving over the whole world, we actually did more harm to ourselves than protect ourselves. But I think a lot of that is rooted in a lack of humility and a lack of kind of courage to let go of control.
Absolutely. And the same goes for the sage on the stage model of teaching, right? When we educators, we don't see ourselves as just the dispensers of facts, but as a companion on and mentor on this shared learning journey. And students, I think, really respond well to that invitation to be agents in the learning process. And I think can develop more respect and a sense of connectedness to their teachers, too, when they see their teachers as humans, right? Who have their own questions, who haven't figured everything out, but are humble enough to say, let's find out together, and to really follow students' authentic curiosity, because many times students will forget what they wrote on a test within a few days, right? But the seeds of curiosity and awe and wonder can animate a student's discovery for the rest of their life and their sense of meaning, their sense of belonging. It's really emphasizing that on a consistent way in our schools and our educational environments is so important. It's not so much what we learn all the time, but how we learn and why we're learning the way we are.
Sam King, thank you so much for joining us on Reimagining. Thank you for your curiosity, for your questions, and thank you for letting us learn with you today.
Absolutely. It's been so great to chat with you, Theodore. Thanks so much for having me.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.